Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to a conversation that holds enormous potential to change every one of our lives. The way we work, how we view work, view money, how people retire, even where we live, how we especially view other people. It even stretches to how the world conducts international affairs. It could actually change everything. The simple idea of my next guest on Open House, social economist and entrepreneur Dr. Michael Schluter, is this: to see life through a relational lens as God sees it. It's simple to say, yet when you consider the way we do life, the way we work, how we view work, view money, where we live, how people even retire, how we especially view other people and international affairs, it's a hugely radical concept. The highly respected Fairfax economics columnist Ross Gittins says few people have had a greater influence on him than Michael Schluter. If genius is being the first person to say the obvious, Gittins says, Dr. Schluter is a genius. And the obvious is this: the importance of human relationships. So, to a conversation which will dig deeply into all three of our Open House benchmarks, life, faith and culture. Dr. Michael Schluter, welcome to Open House.
Thank you.
It's a great honour to have you with us. Thanks so much, Michael. This is, in a way, curious to hear from an economist, because we've been conditioned to think that the economy and our economic well-being is the most important thing for governments, for society, for life.
Obviously, money matters to all of us. We all need to live,
yeah.
And people's income often enables them to take holidays, to eat better, go to restaurants, generally enjoy themselves, so don't want to underestimate the importance of economics. But in a sense, even economics ultimately is about how we relate, because underneath every economic transaction, there's a relationship. There's a relationship between the buyer and the seller, between the customer and the bank, or the customer and the supermarket. There's a relationship between the supermarket and its supply chain. Wherever you look, even in economics, you're really talking relationships.
You say that our ever-increasing material affluence over the past 200 years has been achieved at the expense of our relationships, though. In what ways?
Too often it gets to be like that, doesn't it? Just think of the number of hours that we're working today compared to, say, 20, 30 years ago. I'm seeing people working 50, 60, 70 hours a week, certainly if they're in management, they're working those sorts of hours. And I remember we did a study in Relationships Forum Australia, which showed that Australia has some of the longest working hours in the world. You know, the old view of laid-back Australia is kind of history now.
Yes.
In fact,
yep.
Everybody's working these huge hours, and that just doesn't leave you much time for your friendships and your family. I mean, that would be one example. Someone living in Melbourne gets offered a job in Perth, and they move over there. And, of course, then the wife or partner and the children have to move as well. And then they leave behind their elderly parents. And you sort of think, well, what's happened to the relationships in the family then? I mean, what's more important, a 10% rise in salary, a slightly better position for one member of the family? Or is it more important to provide stability and long-term community and extended family relationships at home?
The whole work-life balance issue is a very important one for you, and I've not heard people speak like you in the public space about this distance that's increasingly opening up between family members. When we were growing up, it was a big thing to move interstate around Australia. Now it's typical that young people will move overseas to pursue jobs.
Relational distance, we call it relational distance, which is quite connected to physical distance, but it's kind of more than that. It's a cultural factor as well. For example, the differences in pay levels between the top and the bottom of a company. So if the managing director is paid, as they are probably in most big American and Australian corporates, something like 500 times more than the person on the checkout or the person on the till or whatever it may be, if there's a 500-to-1 type pay differential, that creates a huge difference in perspective, in the ability just to communicate and in the ability to trust one another.
Yes. Michael, tell us about the journey of how you came to your thinking about this. It's based on the fact that the Christian faith is a relational faith. Where did that light dawn? How did that light dawn in your life?
I came to it in a rather unusual way, I suppose. I was working in East Africa, first in the family business and then as an economist with the World Bank. We had a revolution up in Ethiopia, north of us. I was living in Kenya, and there was a revolution in Ethiopia, Marxist one. And then in Tanzania, where I was working with the World Bank, the president was Julius Nyerere, who was a socialist. And in Kenya, we had capitalism. And the students there were asking, well, what is a Christian perspective on capitalism, Marxism, and socialism? And in thinking about that, I was advised by my Baptist pastor at the time that there might be a Christian response to this. We didn't have to just tweak one of these existing ideologies. We might be able to find, if we study the Bible carefully enough, a Christian framework of thinking for the whole of political and economic life. And that led me into a study of quite large parts of biblical teaching, biblical social teaching. And out of all of that, I came to the question, well, what's the big idea behind all this biblical social teaching? What is it that really holds it all together and gives it meaning? And I finally came to a passage where Jesus says, love God and love your neighbor. On these two laws hangs all the law and the prophets. So Jesus was saying, the big idea that holds it together is love. So then I thought, well, hang on, I can't go down to the World Bank office on Monday morning and say to them, look, we're talking about land tenure in Tanzania and people moving out of their traditional homes into the villages. I can't say to the guys in the World Bank office, hey, guys, the answer is love, yes, because they'll think I've sort of gone back to flower power in the 1960s. It's just not going to work. And then I realized that love is about relationships. And actually what Jesus is saying is, look, the whole of life ultimately is about the quality of our relationships. And when I got hold of that idea, that opened up all kinds of new thinking. And that's how I came to it.
Were your colleagues in the World Bank receptive to that then?
I think it took a long time for the penny to fully drop in my own mind. So at the beginning, I thought, fantastic, this is a great breakthrough in thinking. I was really excited about it, but I didn't dare open my mouth in the World Bank office about it because I just thought, I just don't know how to articulate this in a way that makes sense to them. It really took about 10 years of working through issues here in the UK. We ran the Keep Sunday Special campaign. That was about relationships. We got involved in conferences to help end apartheid in South Africa. We discovered that was about relationships. Then there was the big bang in the city, and we got involved in setting up a charity to help people avoid getting into debt. And we found debt was an issue about relationships. I mean, everywhere we looked, it was about relationships. Yes. So it was about 10 years later that I really felt confident to go out into public space and talk about relationships.
As well as the thought of loving God, loving your neighbor, you also point to the great emphasis in the Bible, not on my rights, but on my responsibilities to others.
I mean, I suppose the Ten Commandments is not a bill of rights, is it? I mean, it's more a bill of obligations. It's the things that we ought to do. You know, honor your father and mother, don't steal, don't kill, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. All of those things are obligations that God sets on us. And I guess the more you think about your relationships, the easier it is to get a bit depressed because you realize your relationships are pretty messy things.
Yes.
I mean, all of us make a mess of our relationships. I've never met a person yet who said to me, oh, I've got perfect relationships, you know. So relationships are messy things. And I think that's what's so fantastic about Christianity, that it offers you forgiveness. And that's the way forward. We just got to realize that we do make a mess of our relationships, but that God is waiting there to forgive us if only we'll ask him to. The only thing, really, that God requires of us to forgive us is that we will forgive other people, and that isn't always easy.
Yeah. I always love to be practical with this kind of thinking. In the world of business, for instance, you've developed a 10-step relational business charter where a company's goal actually benefits all its stakeholders, yes, owners, directors, managers, but also employees and also the wider society. That is a big shake-up for capitalism.
Yes, it is. We're saying companies should start to measure their relationships. And I mean, for us, the good news as Christians is that the world out there has realized that a business's success depends fundamentally on the quality of the relationships with its, quotes, stakeholders. Well, who are the stakeholders? Well, the employees, yes, customers, suppliers, shareholders, regulators, government departments, local communities, all of those people have an interest in the business, and the success of the business depends on the quality of those relationships. So now the International Integrated Reporting Council sounds a very grand title, doesn't it? But it's based here in London, actually. The International Integrated Reporting Council is requiring companies to measure those relationships. And we're just establishing now a separate company called Relational Analytics. I mean, we've been working in Australia with KPMG, one of the big four accounting groups, for about a year. And we are measuring relationships that companies have with their stakeholders. And we think this is going to revolutionize capitalism. And we've also developed, as you mentioned, a relational business charter in a paper we wrote called Transforming Capitalism from Within.
And one of the many ways forward is to strengthen the sense of employee share ownership in a company. And that's all about relationship too.
It certainly is. I mean, we have a rather radical idea here, but I'll put it on the table since you've kind of brought it up. What we're saying is that one of the most fundamental problems of capitalism is that it separates the person who has money to invest from where the money is put. So you can imagine somebody, you know, putting their money into a super in Australia, and actually they're not sure where exactly the money is invested. All that seems to matter is, what rate of return am I getting? Am I getting 5%, 6%, 7%? As long as I'm getting a decent rate of return, that's all that matters. But we're suggesting that there needs to be a relationship from between the person who's investing the money and the person who's using the money, and that relationship is core to building a sense of community and people getting to know and trust one another. So we really do want to encourage employees, but also people who are investing money, as far as they can, to know where their money is put and get involved in how the money is used.
Is there a business you can point to where this thinking, this relational business charter, has been applied and has actually worked?
Well, there are lots of companies that come close to it already, and there is a company just setting itself up at the moment based on the relational business charter, but that will be the first one that explicitly has said, we want to implement the charter. But if you take a big retailer in Britain like the John Lewis Partnership, all of their partners, all of their staff, including the people on the checkout, everybody is a partner in the business. And they have a partners' council that meets on a regular basis to discuss key issues in the business that affect the whole partnership. And they have a say on all kinds of issues that are going on. So, I mean, that's a good example of a situation where there's a high level of engagement among the main stakeholders.
I'm sure there is. On Open House, we're with social economist and entrepreneur Dr. Michael Schluter. And in just a moment, how this provocative thinking plays out in three entirely different arenas: international relations, relationships between nation superpowers, the environment, and in social media, where the whole concept of friendship and relationship has been quite turned on its head. Michael, you say we can even see issues, as I said before the break, like the environment through this relational lens. How's it going to work there?
Why should we care about the environment? I think the question of why we should do it is absolutely critical, because it determines our motivation and how much energy we're prepared to put into it. It could be that you look out at the trees and the flowers and you just think, I really love those trees and flowers. I really care about them, so I'm prepared to sacrifice my standard of living to allow that tree to live longer, or I really want these flowers to be able to prosper because I think these flowers are really important. I talk to my flowers, I talk to the trees, and so on. That's one attitude. But I think for most people, the reason that they care for the environment comes down to two things. Either they do it because they love somebody. So they want their children to be able to see porpoises and whales and other sea creatures. So they don't want them wiped off the planet. They feel they're leaving something important to their children. Or they care about people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh and don't want them to be flooded and don't want 200 million people to have to go on the move to other parts of the globe because their land gets flooded. So they're prepared to drive less or use more carbon-efficient cars, whatever it may be, because they mind about other people. So it's partly a love-your-neighbor issue. Or alternatively, they care about the planet because they believe God made the planet. I mean, the mechanism we can debate, but ultimately people either believe that the planet came into existence by chance or they believe a person, God, made it. And if God ultimately was the source of the planet that we live on, then people will look after the planet because they respect the God who made it and realize that they were given this lovely world we live in as a gift from the Creator God. So for both those reasons, it's a very powerful motivation to look after the planet. And I think just recognizing that we're doing it for our neighbor or for our future generations, or that we're doing it for God, makes all the difference in the world to how much we're prepared to sacrifice our own personal lifestyles and enjoyment to look after the planet.
That might necessarily also be a costly financial thing for us to do.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to give up some money, we've got to be well motivated. And I'm suggesting that it's the relational motivation that's key to handling the environmental issues. So I'd like to see the environmental charities stressing that relational motivation much more strongly.
Your concept also turns on its head the whole notion of what it is to be a, quote, developed country, as opposed to developing countries. Let's take the way the West and Arab nations are and relate. Take us through your thinking there.
Yes, I get very frustrated with the way we use the language of developed and developing countries.
Yes.
Because somehow we look down our long noses in high-income countries like Australia, like the UK. We look down our noses at Africa and parts of Asia and so on because we say in our minds and hearts that we are more developed than they are. So the message that goes out to those people is, you should become like us. We are sophisticated. We have got advanced technology. We know how to run our lives. Now you've got to become like us. And it seems to us, seems to me, extremely arrogant as an underlying attitude. And I think the way God views this is quite different. He would say, yes, they're low-income countries in Africa. I know Africa best. I'll talk about that. Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, South Africa, Rwanda, Zimbabwe, Sudan. I've lived in these countries. They would say, I think the good Lord would say, well, they are in fact more developed than we are in Britain and Australia in many cases because their relationships at the level of family and community are much more caring and considerate than ours are. They're much more generous to their neighbors. People can drop in on one another. They'll help each other out in a crisis much more readily than we will. So I think it's much better to use the language of high-income and low-income countries, if that's what we mean. We're just talking about people's wealth. But reserve the language of quotes, development, for thinking about the quality of relationships that a nation has.
Because there's a lot of relational chaos in the West, actually.
Yes, a lot of relational chaos and a lot of loneliness, too. I mean, I'm very struck by how many old people in the West are lonely. I had an African friend who came to visit me here in Cambridge, and he said to me, look, I'm absolutely horrified by the way you treat your old people. We'd never do this in Africa. Put an old person in old people's home and then never visit them. I mean, what kind of relationship is that?
Can I ask you again about one specific instance where this has played out in practice, this time at an international level? You're involved in events in Rwanda. Can you set the context for us and how this relational lens changed Rwanda and its people?
The issue in Rwanda was about as bad a set of relationships as you can possibly imagine. So you may remember back in the 1990s, started in 1994, about 800,000 people, it may have even been a million, were cut to pieces in a genocide. And it was very brutal because a lot of it was done just with a sort of machete that people were using. And there are terrible scenes of people going up to roadblocks and then getting hacked to pieces by other people who are laughing in the process of doing it. I mean, it's just inconceivable brutality. But it happened, and it happened within a three-month period. And the West, by and large, just looked on from afar and did absolutely nothing to intervene. It was really seriously bad. That relationship between Hutus and Tutsis, two ethnic groups, had been boiling up for decades. There had been previous massacres before this one, but that was the culmination of it. Well, how on earth do you intervene in a period like that? And we were involved in a number of things to try and bring healing into that situation. Part of it was very mundane. It was about food production. So part of the problem was that food production had peaked. They were doubling their population every 15 years or so, because they had the highest growth rate, population growth rate in Africa, and there was no more land to move on to, and they were encouraged not to use fertilizers by the international community for environmental reasons. And the result was, with declining per capita food production, there was less and less food for people to eat, more and more unemployed young people, and that boiled up towards violence, rather like in Europe. It led to extraordinary violence after the Great Depression. So if you have a declining economic environment, you can expect violence. But part of it was wider than that. And I remember running an attempt to get a Truth and Reconciliation Commission going, like the one they had in South Africa, in Rwanda. We got the church leaders together, the government leaders together, to discuss holding a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And just to give you a small illustration of what happens in that situation, I remember a church leader. He was quite a prominent church leader at the time. We asked him to speak on the importance of reconciliation in that environment. And what we got was a half an hour diatribe from him about how awful the Hutu ethnic group were because of the violence they'd perpetrated against the Tutsis. And he was really vitriolic against this other group. Over coffee, I said to another church leader, look, what hope is there if the church leaders can't even say anything about forgiveness?
Yes.
And this church leader friend I was talking to just looked at me and he said, if your wife and six children had all been cut to pieces just a year ago, what do you think you'd be saying? And it just made me realize the depth of the hurt and the hatred that still lay beneath the surface.
Yes.
Now, where do you go to bring healing in that situation? You can paper over the cracks with economic growth, but it seems to me you need something much deeper than that if you're going to get forgiveness and reconciliation. Part of it has to be very personal and can only be done, I think, through realizing how much Christ himself suffered on the cross, the depth of his suffering in being separated from God the Father and taking the wrath of God upon himself, as I understand it. But part of it is also about introducing the theme of relationships and forgiveness into every part of public life, into the way you run your education, your health system, your finance, your business, and making relationships the centerpiece of the way you think about all those things.
So can I ask you about our online world? Is it possible to see that world and others through this relational lens when there's no personal contact and in an arena where we have so many, inverted commas, friends?
Yes, I think it's important to understand what a relationship is. And we argue that relationships operate in five zones, if you like, simultaneously. One of them is communication. Another of them is the sense of continuity or story in the relationship. How long do people know each other? Another of them is how wide or deep is your knowledge of the other party. A fourth one is the sense of parity, mutual respect, participation, and so on. And the fifth one is a sense of shared goals and purpose. Now, what the online world allows you to do is to keep in touch with a lot more people very much more easily. So I have a daughter who lives in Japan. I can ring her every Sunday, like I shall today,
yes,
to talk to her, and that's fantastic to be able to do that. and helps me maintain the relationship. Or I can be in touch with friends or develop relationships with people all over the world. Someone got in touch with me from the Harvard Business School last week, and I would never get to know this woman were it not for the convenience of the internet. But there is a huge downside, and I think we need to be very aware of that, so that if young people, for example, today are spending a lot of time texting and being on their iPhones and so on, do they have continuity in those relationships? Is it possible to resolve points of difference, or do people simply switch off the iPhone if they don't like what they're hearing? Is it possible to develop such a deep relationship if you don't have face-to-face contact with people? So we're arguing that face-to-face is absolutely key to deep relationships because, I mean, you never meet someone who got engaged to be married to someone that they'd never met face-to-face.
Yes.
Or, I don't know, have you ever met anybody like that?
No, heaven forbid. Michael, for the future, with the aging population that's already upon us, you make a distinction between the financial capital a retiree will build up and their relational capital that will see them into old age. Take us through your thinking there, because I think that's going to be very, very relevant in the decades ahead.
Yeah, I think it's already very, very relevant.
Yes.
I agree. So we talk about not just building a financial pension by putting aside money every week or every month into that, but also building a relational pension. So when you retire, what you want is a stock of good relationships with your family and your friends and so on, so that you've got lots of people who can share your later years with you and give you a sense of fun, community, and doing things together, which otherwise you miss. So how do you build a relational pension? Well, I heard a case a couple of weeks ago of a friend of mine whose daughter is in South Africa working with animals, actually, and she's so enjoying herself down there and having a great time that when her boyfriend of 8 years said, look, come on, let's get married and have children and settle down, she said, sorry, not interested. I want to stay in Africa and mess around with the animals. You stay in Britain and get on with your life. And I thought, this lady's not thinking long term. I mean, looking after animals in Africa may be great fun for a year or two, but if you want a relational pension, you need to think about having children. You need to think about investing in a long-term relationship with a partner, and getting married and having a commitment to live in the long term with people.
Yeah.
But equally, if you work very, very long hours, which is usually to do with your relationship with your boss in the office or your relationship with your customers, whatever it may be, you often sacrifice putting time into building the relationship you have with your wife or your husband or your children or your partner. You don't invest for those long-term relationships and those long-term benefits because you're so busy simply doing things for the short-term and the present. So we're saying, look, think long-term. Invest time every month into building those most important relationships. My wife and I have monthly couple days. So every month we spend a day when we just focus on one another. Actually, one was yesterday for us, usually a Saturday. And we simply try and drop everything else and spend time together for a day. Well, it's those kinds of practical things that help build relationships on a long-term basis.
Such great wisdom in all of this. I'm so glad that you've spared us such generous time, Michael Schluter. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House. It's been great talking.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.